Well, well, welcome to Between Sundays. I'm Tyler, and today I'm radically renunciating my power. Today we're talking about the role and invitation to husbands according to scripture. But before we die to ourselves, now that they've thumped their chests and turned back into alpha hosts, let's welcome in our favorite household code breakers, Maren and Barry. Good day, guys.
Good day. Good morning. Good hours of the morning.
Yeah, we're doing this early, guys. Oh, man. Is the sun even up? It's Monday morning. Barry's on his way out of town, so we had to just get here quick. Yeah, we had to scramble and get ourselves presentable in the morning.
Thank you, guys.
Camera ready.
Yeah. Guys, what's new? What's going on?
You looked at me.
Yeah, because you're leaving. You're the guy with all the plans, right? You've got the things to do.
I'm going down to a friend's lake house for a couple of days. Like, it's cold. The boats aren't working yet. So it's not like, don't think like luxury vacation. But I just needed a place where I could hole up and just do writing because I've got classes coming up. I'm recording my Bible skeptics class. I'm going to do kind of an online course with a whole bunch of different videos. So I've got a lot of work to do to prep the content. I'm doing my Revelation class that I mentioned. That'll be towards the end of this month. So I want to work on that a little bit. So, and then we're going to Orlando next week to go to the Disabilities and the Church conference and found out we have a good number of folks coming to our breakout. So it's a lot of writing and a lot of teaching, and I love it, but I needed some distraction-free time to hole up and write.
So, other than like scaring everybody with the AI image of your Revelation
terrifying
hey,
class,
it's literally biblical. It's exactly what it says.
You showed me that image like, I don't know, before the weekend. And I thought you were just playing around. I didn't know you were going to show it in the service.
Could you have warned mothers with small children?
Maybe I should have.
Yeah.
Told that to John the Revelator.
Yeah. So what can people expect out of your Revelation class?
Beasts from the sea, obviously.
With horns and many heads.
That's right. It got a little confused when it tried
to do. It did look like a leopard.
It says it has the body of a leopard, the feet of a bear, and the face of a lion. Faces of a lion, all seven heads.
God rules.
I did have to remove one of the heads because the AI got very confused and I kept trying. I was like, no, not eight heads, seven. And it's like, okay, here's an image with seven heads. I was like, it's still eight. So the future is not yet here.
Not now.
I'll just say this. The way people normally in kind of our evangelical sphere, the way we normally look at Revelation is we think of it kind of like a Nostradamus code book of predictions.
Yeah.
And it's all about like, okay, which beast is Vladimir Putin? And it's always like trying to like, interpret it in our day. And I'm just becoming more and more convinced that that's just not what the book was meant to be. And so this class is my attempt to try to, in a way, kind of start from scratch and ask the question of what was this book for in the early church? Mm-hmm. Why do we still pass this on through our scriptures? Why is this such an important text? And I've been doing a ton of reading and understanding and study about ancient Asia Minor, first century imperial cults of Rome, like all kinds of cool stuff like that. And it all helps significantly to understand the imagery, the context, and how it applies to us today.
Yeah.
It's just not in the way that people generally tend to think. It applies to us in a much more, in my opinion, profound way, and should be an incredible warning and an incredible encouragement to the modern church. So that's what the class is all about.
So when you show the full length movie of Left Behind, are you going to do the Kirk Cameron version or the Nicolas Cage version?
Obviously Nicolas Cage, because you've got to know that's going to be the good one. So that's not necessarily how it'll go. Okay. And my hope is I'm going to try to really focus in on some of the key images, like the beast from the sea, like the slaughtered lamb, the Lion of Judah, which is the slaughtered lamb, like some key images that will help people when they're doing their own reading, be able to kind of make sense of some of these core ideas. So it's going to be great. I'm excited.
All right.
And not everyone's going to love it. And I bet a whole bunch of people will get really disappointed and leave after week one. When I'm not identifying modern characters and stuff like that. But I think it's important. So,
all right.
Yeah. We love a good conspiracy theory. You know, that's why people get so into that book. They love asking the questions of
cracking the code.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't want to spoil too much of the class, but there is a bunch of that. It's just it's in the ancient world. It's like the conspiracy that Nero was going to come back at the head of a Persian army. Everyone was like rumoring that. And so there's this concept. He's like a, How are you guys?
How long have you been putting material together for this class? Because I feel like you you walked into a room like 2 years ago and you're like, guys.
Yep, I did.
Revelation.
I know. Probably at least 2 years, 3 years, because I do have a segment in my skeptics class trying to reinterpret what revelation is a little bit. And that kind of became the seedbed for this. And then honestly, I'm going to Greece later this year. So I'm going to Corinth. And so I've been doing some research to try to understand Corinth, which ended up being, which ended up leading me into trying to understand the imperial cult, which led me to a book that came that I didn't even know existed called Imperial Cults and the Apocalypse of John. And so that
was
book,
made for you.
Yeah. It's like Dewberry. So cool. And literally this I'm like going to fanboy over this professor guy that's probably never even anyway. And I have been having a blast. So it's good times. All right. Enough about me. What about you guys?
I really don't get sick. Here's what I think happened. I have a theory. Mm-hmm. It's just a theory. I've been able to ward off sickness, especially before big events like Christmas and Easter.
I'm guessing
like,
this is going to be really scientific, this theory.
as are all of my theories, Barry. You know this. But I feel it coming on, and then I go and I do hot yoga, and I sweat it out for like a full hour. And I feel like if I can just sweat out the thing that's trying to destroy me, that I can like keep beating it. And so I've been beating
it. So hot yoga.
But then last week, we had core team. I was just so busy, and I missed my opportunity to sweat it out, and it got the best of me. So
honestly,
I was just very sick
I'm surprised, because that actually could be a reasonable theory because there are.
Are you surprised that reasonable theories are coming from my mind?
Reasonably, like evidence. Evidence.
Tell me what's surprising about this.
Sorry. What I mean is, I was expecting you to say like, but I thought my way through it, and I know that I can't at Christmas time.
Power through.
But like, there's a lot of cultures that do like hot rooms, steam rooms, like that's a normal thing, and people do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Outcomes with it. So.
I typically can ward off minor sicknesses like a cold or flu or whatever, but it got the better of me.
Well,
I'm telling you.
Sorry I prevented you from going to hot yoga because I scheduled
core team.
Yeah.
So when you're sick, Maren, do you sleep all day? Do you try to push through doing normal things? What do you do?
Shout out to my body's ability to sleep all day and all night. All day and all night. Like, when I'm down, I'm just all the way down. Whoa. So I never left my bed. I never left the couch and was still able to sleep all through the night and all through the day. Mm-hmm. And then woke up the next day feeling markedly better.
Yeah.
Still not like 100%, but pretty good on Saturday. Sunday felt almost completely back to normal. Sunday was cool. I was here at the 9:15 service. But I had to cut out right away immediately following the 9:15 service. Cause remember Enrique Lira, who played violin and keys here at Grace? Well, he is now the worship pastor for a Spanish speaking congregation that meets at White River in Noblesville.
Right.
Noblesville. That's right. But Jaden plays drums for them occasionally. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have any responsibilities directly tied to services here at Grace yesterday. So I was able to cut out, go see Jaden play in the Spanish speaking congregation. And it was so much fun. It was awesome. Yeah. So it was fun. That was my weekend.
Yeah. All right. I got to do a murder mystery over the weekend.
Yeah.
Murder mystery party.
Like for somebody's birthday?
Yeah, it was my sister-in-law's birthday. Mm.
What was the theme?
It was murder at the manor.
Oh, so kind of classic.
Yeah,
clue.
classic. And I was the
Wait, is this Hannah's birthday?
No, it was Lauren's brother's wife.
Oh, okay.
So I was Professor Peacock.
Oh.
And I thought like all right, I'm going to do like a corduroy jacket, corduroy vest, tie, like glasses, and like, I don't know, like Peaky Blinders style hat or something.
Is that the hat that you wore when Desi told you look like Bert from Mary Poppins?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is where I'm going with this. I show up and everybody's like, where's your costume? Everybody's like, that's what you normally wear.
That is what you
Because we did like a costume contest and I thought I was like very stepping up my game or
period
something.
Accurate.
Yeah. And they're like,
that's funny.
You look like you.
so funny.
We did not win the murder mystery. We all lost because the person who did the murder was sneaky and nobody wasn't on anybody's radar.
Wow.
Yeah. But my kids were totally invested. Like they just sat there watching the whole thing play out. And they didn't really understand because like Marissa is whose birthday it was. And she was playing a character, a widow character. And so her husband's the one who was murdered. And so my kids were like, but if her husband was murdered, Luke's right there.
Right.
How is her husband murdered if Luke's still alive? So like they couldn't figure out, like we're all playing characters here.
Yeah. Right. After permanence, but he's right there.
Yeah. And then we went to 915 as well. And Lauren says she's interested in becoming a 915 fan.
Whoa.
Well, I will say from firsthand experience, Lou was a different child before 915. I get why so many young families go to 915.
Yeah.
She was just bright and bubbly. And
It's before her nap.
Wow.
So we went because Milo has a friend from school who came to church. Mm. And so we went so he could be in the same class and all that stuff. But as we're going, Lauren's like, we could be a 915 family. I'm like, oh man.
That changes everything.
But it was good. I mean, we got home at, 10:45, 11 o'clock and got to work outside the rest of the day and all that stuff. But
wow.
I don't know. I kind of hope we don't become a 915 family, but she's
no offense
she's into
to
it.
All of you wonderful, lovely 915ers.
No, it's nothing about you guys. It's just like getting everybody out of the house. That early is tough.
That would be challenging.
Yeah.
But if the payoff at the other side of it is worth it, I guess.
Yeah.
Nap time.
Yeah.
And then in a couple weeks, Lauren's going out of town for like 5 days. And so it's just going to be me and the kids. And I've developed a little like anxiety.
No.
Maybe this will come out in our husband's conversation, but I've developed a little anxiety because I'm probably in the camp of like, I don't share the mental load as much as...
And you're about to get the entire load.
Yeah, and I'm going to get the whole load. And she, on the way home from church yesterday, she's like, what can I do to like help you like not feel stressed out about this? And I was like, I don't even know where to begin. Like, she's like, maybe I'll just write out an entire schedule for you every day.
Would that be helpful?
I guess, but it was right on the heels of like share the mental load. And I was like, she shouldn't have to do that. I should learn the schedule and just figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's some things that you probably don't know just because your schedule is that you are here in this building throughout the week.
Yeah.
There's just some things she does that she does because she can do it and you're not there to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. If a schedule would be helpful, I think that's a great plan.
Yeah. So that's step one. And then, I've got a little, anxiety because we're approaching pretty quickly about it. So I don't know. She's going to be out of the country.
Right.
That's where she's going. So it's not even like,
oh, that's right. That's that trip.
It's not even, she's reachable really.
You are like all on your own.
Yeah.
Do you have like your parents as backup? Do you have like,
I mean, my mom's going with her.
Oh, wow.
So I could call my dad, but
yeah,
he's about as helpful as I am. So yeah.
You may need some reinforcements.
Yeah. We got to figure that
you'll
out.
You'll be great. I'm sure. Yeah.
I'll be sure nothing will ever go wrong. Nope.
None of the kids will get sick. It'll be flawless.
Oh, goodness. Every time she does leave, somebody gets deathly sick.
Yeah.
We should start casting lots. Which of his kids is going to get
put that on me.
What's the over under on?
Don't put that on me.
Lane.
Oh, man. All right, guys. We're going to move to our new sermon series called All in the Family.
Yeah.
And Barry, you typically like to set up the series before we enter into the week's sermon. And so as a designer of the series, and what are you hoping everybody kind of takes away or comes away with as a whole for this chunk of time?
Sure. Well, first of all, as far as like why we are doing this series, I recognize in myself as a teacher that I often am comfortable speaking in terms of very big concepts and kind of trusting people to listen to the Spirit and apply it in their own lives. But every now and then, it's really good to have a hyper-practical series where we are just talking about specific people sitting there and specific things that they're facing, et cetera. And so I thought, well, let's do that with some family demographics, husbands, wives, singles, children, parents and elders, like the people that we see sitting around us. And ideally, almost everybody will have one, if not two or three messages that apply to them, depending on where they are in life. So that's the kind of the concept. Let's look at scripture and ask, what is God's invitation to these different groups of people
yeah.
at this time in our culture, in our church, in this family, all this right. big family. So that's what it's all about. And so we started with husbands.
Yeah, taking husbands to the woodshed.
Well, there's really no other way to do it. I felt the content of what I shared, some of that content would be familiar to the guys that came to my husband's retreat mm-hmm. back in July, which was all about the servant-hearted husband. And we looked at several passages, but Ephesians 5 was one that I really tried to hammer home. And so that's what this sermon was about. And what I really wanted to do in this was to introduce the emphasis that I think is Paul's emphasis in his time and place, which is this household code that he gives of how people should behave. And he paints the picture in that time of wives not rocking the boat by being, you know, submitting to their husbands, because that was the way the world worked back then. Don't tear into two what was meant to be one with your newfound freedom in Christ. Mm-hmm. But then the entire rest of the passage is about husbands. Mm-hmm. And he says, you need to love your wives like Christ loved the church. He gave up his life for her, which the idea of loving your wife with self-sacrifice and surrender is already provocative. But I tried to draw the picture out a little further to say, in the ancient world, in Paul's context, this would have been insane. Like, this is an absolutely extreme thing to say to husbands. And so with that extremity in mind, I think the call to husbands today is a pretty significant one. Yeah. We need to learn how to be servants to our wives. And ideally, and we can talk about this, but ideally, it's mutual submission. So the wives are also serving us, and it's this race to the bottom of mutual submission mm-hmm. where each is looking out for the needs of the other, giving way for the other, lifting up the other. And it's this beautiful, harmonious concept of marriage. But we had to start somewhere. We're going to start with the husbands.
All right.
So I don't know if the big idea is a Christ-like husband is a self-crucified husband or a self-giving husband.
So Ephesians 5 is controversial? Is Ephesians 5 controversial, or is it just like kind of problematic, or what we've turned it into?
Well, it's controversial depending on who you're with.
Yeah.
I had some congregants tell me that they were just at a church in Florida that when they were down there, and they heard a message on this exact passage, and the entire sermon was about how wives should submit to their husbands.
Yeah.
And so they came in and they were like, wow, this was a very different and refreshing to them. They said, approach the same passage, but it's, so I don't know if controversial is the right word. I think it has been used. This passage has been used as license to do a lot of very unhealthy things, mm-hmm. especially in the church, to tell women that, you know, well, you shouldn't seek help when you're being abused. You need to submit to your husband or women should, you know, neglect their gifts and skills and talents because they're supposed to submit and stay home, and they're not supposed to work. It's just been used for all kinds of stuff that I would say is missing the point.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
I've seen sermons about this, about both for wives and for husbands. And usually they say something that I've seen. They say something like, all right, today we're talking about wives, but you have to come back next week because we're not just going to leave it there. We're going to talk about husbands next. Is the design of the series kind of like that? It's like this is 6 weeks?
6 weeks. Yeah.
This is a six part sermon, and you got to be present for all of it to understand how the whole puzzle fits together. Or is it like, could we walk away from here and come back 5 weeks later and be like, all right, we're good. Like we understand the invitation to all these roles.
I don't know. And I don't know that every week is going to be perfectly like fitting like a glove with all the other ones. Cause I kind of, as I was seeking out which passages to use in this series, I was more thinking, okay, what do the husbands in our church need to hear right now? And so I've got this conviction about the need for husbands to learn self-sacrifice. And that's why we went to Ephesians 5. For wives, off the top of my head, I don't even know the passage that we're doing.
I couldn't wait, as I sat in the front row yesterday and listened to your message, I couldn't wait to hear what Amy will say to wives.
Yeah.
Especially in light of the message you just gave.
Right. It's not Ephesians 5, though. That's my point.
Oh, okay.
She's going to preach from a different passage mm-hmm. to the wives at Grace. So anyway.
Yeah. Ephesians 5, the whole thing is all about people living as people of the light, Christians living in a way that manifests Christ to the world around them as people of the light. And I think that's really what this whole series is going to be about. Mm-hmm, all in the right. family. What's God's invitation to husbands? How does God want husbands to represent him to the world? How does God want husbands to live? I'm preaching about parents next week. Same thing. It's this, you know, Barry talks about it a lot, about us showing the world that there is a different way to live. That's essentially what all of Ephesians 5 is about. Right. Yeah. When you read, you know, we tend to isolate the wife part and the husband part, but when you read the whole thing in context, it's really just about how to be Christ's representatives in the world and show the world that there's another way to live. So I think that's what the entire series will encapsulate.
Right. Yep.
Do we have any idea how Paul's male audience received this?
From a single guy.
What? Yeah. Yeah. From a guy who wasn't married.
Right. I mean, I don't know that I have, there's not really any evidence to speak of specific people's responses to this. Off the top of my head, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I do know that there were some later church fathers that like second century, third century, who kind of went, they kind of backslid a little bit when it came to like the role of wives and husbands. And they started getting a little bit more conservative and traditional and like, and wives should go back. And it's like, this is one of those odd developments, because you see Jesus have all these women that are like part of his inner circle. Mary Magdalene preached on Easter, right? And you know, you see all these women. Then you see and Mary Magdalene's the first evangelist and all that. Then you see Paul, and he's giving the letter to the Romans. He's entrusting the letter to the Romans to Phoebe as this you know, apostle to take it to Rome and teach that. You've got references in Paul to female prophets, female teachers, and like all this incredible stuff. And then you get into like third century, fourth century, and there just aren't many women elevated to that level. It's almost like the world wasn't ready for something like that. And so anyway, I don't know. What was the question? Because I'm like, all the well, pushback.
How do you think Paul's male audience received this? Because if it was so countercultural in a patriarchal society, I can't imagine that this was like, oh yeah, that's a good idea, let's just do that, like, you know.
Right. Well, I've heard stories, and I hesitate to always compare things to like rural India to the ancient world. However, there's a lot of similarities culturally, and I have heard stories of when people in that context have like very, very new believers have heard passages like this, and they hear about mutual submission and the idea that there should be love between spouses and sacrifice for the sake of the other. Like, it's provocative, it's transformative, and there are all these stories of especially men in a very patriarchal setting who have completely profoundly changed their ways, and wives are, you know, in awe and sharing the good news. It's actually like a vehicle for the gospel to spread, because people can look at them and say, wow, their lives are different. And so I've heard testimonies of that. I imagine there's other people who would just say, whatever, that's hogwash. I'm not going to serve my wife. I'm the master here, or whatever. Yeah. So I'm sure it all depends on the person and the spirits working in their heart in advance of it. But I know that it does resonate in some contexts, even in very patriarchal settings.
Yeah. You kind of started off by talking about some of the negative portrayals of husbands or men in general. Yeah. How do you think these portrayals have impacted like societally men's view of themselves? Like I don't know. You did a husband's retreat a year ago. Like,
right.
You've probably heard stories of men and women, whether they're married or not, like talk about some of the angst that they feel or how they view themselves. Like, how do you feel like these negative portrayals impacts us societally?
Yeah. Well, I'm curious to know what you guys think. I think it's significantly a self-fulfilling prophecy, where we set the tone, we set the expectation that men are doofuses, men are lazy, men are just gonna, boys will be boys, like all that stuff. And we paint the picture so consistently that like, men are pretty much good for nothing around the house or in the family or whatever, that it becomes harder and harder for men to break free of that stereotype. And they start to find more and more license, implicit license, to fulfill that stereotype because it's what's expected of them. And so I think it would be a very different world if what normal looks like, if every depiction and this is re- ridiculous, but if every depiction in popular culture of husbands was of like godly self-sacrificing men who are looking out for others and using their strength to lift up the family and their wives, like if that was normal, I think the average man would look at his own life and think, wow, I'm falling short of normal. But instead, normal is every sitcom dad that is good for nothing. And, and so it just does not empower men to think that they should be working harder to change the view, because it's what's normal. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, the example I gave about 5 minutes ago about how my wife is leaving and that's how it's impacted me, I guess. I don't know. I'm not going to blame it on anybody but me, but like that is the good for nothing, like the archetype. It's like if I was going out of town for 4 days, is anybody being like, Lauren, how can we help? You know, nobody's doing that. Right. But if she goes out of town for 4 days, it's like, oh, we gotta get surround Tyler with like, we gotta get groceries ahead of time. We gotta write out the schedule. We gotta like, my dad's like, hey, I'll take off work, whatever, you know, like nobody's doing that for my wife. Right. And so I don't know. I feel like for us, at least, that's kind of been, something that stands out to me is the negative stereotypes that we, see in society have kind of infiltrated my life that way. It's like nobody would think about that if I was leaving town for Lauren, but, or like dad comes to bring cookies to school or something.
Right.
Everybody's like, oh, that's amazing.
So amazing. What an incredible amazing dad. Job. I know.
The bar is so low. Yeah, but the bar is so low.
If Lauren did that, it's just like, that's what moms do or whatever. Right. But yeah. So I don't know. It's becoming more, it shined a light on something that I think we see a lot, but it just stood out to me. Yeah. That's what we're dealing with.
And on one hand, like I want to just acknowledge that there are some things that happen naturally, like a woman is the one who gives birth to the child, is the one who's nurturing the child, feeding the child, like for you know, the first couple of years, it is just naturally going to be the mother's experience of being the one who's intimately connected with the biological rhythms of her child. The dad just can't do that. And so things like that where, there's this inevitability of like, she's going to know better than you what that child needs at a given moment because she's dialed in. But as the child ages, presumably, ideally, the dad would become more and more dialed into the needs of the child, more into the rhythms and stuff like that. So that's where it gets difficult, because I think we get used to what naturally happens and needs to happen, and then we kind of never actually shift gears as the child gets older. And that's one example, but I think that same kind of thing happens in a lot of different settings. Like perhaps some women are more naturally wired to want to do details for a vacation or something like that. And so they'll be the ones thinking about it way ahead of time. They're the ones thinking about all the stuff that needs to get done. And the husband's a little late to the party to figure all that kind of stuff out. And so you do that a few times and eventually, well, she's the one who takes care of vacations. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I think it just kind of, it's the ruts that we get caught in over time. I don't know. What do you think, Marianne?
Well, in light of what you guys are talking about, I think a lot of it depends on how your specific family is structured. I'm thinking of a family where the wife works, but she works from home and she's got two little toddlers. And so she knows her toddler's schedule better than her husband does, because her husband is not working from home. You know what I mean? How can he be expected to know what he can't know because he's not there during those daytime hours, you know, Monday through Friday? And so some of it I don't think is so much a stereotype as it is a byproduct of just the way that our homes are structured. Mm-hmm. I think the problem is when husband comes home from work and thinks his job is done.
Yeah, we're done for the day.
That's right. You don't know the day I had at the office. And maybe it was a stressful day, but guaranteed the wife also had a stressful day. Sure. And that's where the rub comes. That's where like the challenge of racing to the bottom, that's where it really gets real, when you're both tired, when you're both stressed, when you both have every reason to want to check out.
Right.
But then, you know, again, the mutual submission of how can I serve you? That's where the rubber meets the road.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And it's rare that both parties think of their day as, well, we both just put in 8 hours right. and now we're both tired and now we have got other things that have to get done tonight.
Yeah.
So let's figure out how to do them together. That's not the way people think. It's, you're right. It's like, well, you got to be home. You got to take a nap, yeah. you know, while the kids were napping, you got to take a nap or whatever. And it's like, we both have some work to do tonight. Yeah.
All right. So I want to park on the concept of mutual submission for a second. Obviously we're talking about husbands here, but you said that mutual submission for husbands in that time meant a complete renunciation of power.
Yeah.
Do you think, especially in a patriarchal society, do you think that's the same for today? Like mutual submission, is that like the perception of mutual submission? Do you think men view that as a renunciation of power?
I think it's different because we use different language, and it also depends on the couple. It depends on the man. But in some settings, I think men do have still significant power. It's not like power, like they, you know, literally, you know, beat their chest and command everybody on what to do. But like men can do things that women can't do. Men can, in the sense of like, they can go out at night by themselves and not think twice about it. Mm-hmm. Whereas women are thinking twice about going out by themselves at night in the mm-hmm. city or whatever. It's things like that, which are, or even like the opportunities that are afforded to men that are not afforded to women, the pay gap, there's mm-hmm. all kinds of different things where there is still an implicit inequality in the power dynamics of our world. We're not first century Anatolia, but we are definitely still patriarchal in the way that our society is structured. So there is some of that. There's also situations where if for the men who are really living into the stereotypes, there's the complete power dynamic has flipped where it's the wife who is the one that's ruling the household, the one that's making all the decisions. And so there is, I think that's part of what makes this passage complicated to interpret, is that in the modern world, not all of the same cultural assumptions are at play.
Yeah.
We have to take the core of what it's about for mm-hmm. them mm-hmm. and then interpret it in our own setting, in our own families. What does it look like for us? Yeah.
Yeah. So, it just seems like, I have a question about this a little bit later, but it seems like the words like mutual submission, mm-hmm. it seems like the perception is that to do that, men have to lose something. And I don't know that, I mean, you talked about how you argued that mutual submission is a loving act that benefits both people. But if we do live in a patriarchal society, the perception may be, well, in order to have that benefit, I have to lose, I'm losing something. I'm losing my influence, or I'm losing, weakness, or relinquishing my role as head of household or something sure. like that. Do you guys think that's true? Like, is there a negative perception of what the word submission means in a marriage?
I think by and large, the word submission gets relegated almost entirely to the wife. That's yeah. what we talked about. Like people just, they make the wife part of this passage the main thing. That's how we're used to hearing it, I guess. I don't know that men really key in on the mutualness of that submission.
Yeah.
At least not like, I guess not the wide scope of it. You know, I know that we do that here, but I'm just thinking like, again, when I've heard this passage preached elsewhere mm-hmm. and that family and that was at that church in Florida, they're not used to hearing this in light of any kind of mutual submission. The mm-hmm. husband is not necessarily ascribing that word to himself because he's so keyed in on the wives submit to your right. husband part. So I don't even know that they're thinking about it.
Yeah. Because it is interesting. I mean, I was reading through the scripture, the Ephesians 5 this morning, and it doesn't say husbands submit to your wives.
Right.
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 It says wives submit to your husbands. Husbands love your wives.
Right.
So I imagine some of the arguments that we would be facing against this type of sermon is like, it never says husbands need to submit.
Right.
It never explicitly says that.
But it says submit to one another, right?
Right.
Out of reverence for Christ.
But you're right, Tyler, that it doesn't spell it out. It doesn't say husbands, submit to your
yeah.
wives. My argument was that it says submit to one another and then there's no verb. It just says wives to your husbands.
Yeah.
And then the next paragraph, husbands to your wives.
Yeah.
So it says as much, in my opinion, it says husbands submit to your wives as much as it says wives submit to your husbands, because it doesn't say that to either, literally.
Yeah, and it doesn't say wives love your husbands.
Right.
It says husbands love your wives. So right. If you're using
and wives respect your
if
husband.
You're using that logic, mm-hmm. It's like, well, it never explicitly says wives need to love their husbands, but we would never say
that
wives don't need to love their husbands.
Exactly.
But somehow we've said it doesn't explicitly say submit to your wives, so therefore we don't need to do that
right.
part. And that's interesting to me.
And I think so much of why we major on this passage and why so many in the church have made such a big deal out of wives submit to your husbands is because there's a general sense in, I would say, like ideologically conservative circles, perhaps, that as time has gone on and as women have become more empowered, have had more education, have had more freedom, that in some way we're losing something with that.
Yeah.
That it's somehow a danger or a risk. And so wives that are now domineering in their household, that's a problem. We've got to get back to wives submitting to your husbands,
yeah,
because that's the way it's quote unquote supposed to be. We have this train of thought because we look at the world today, we think, oh, we got to go back to the way it's supposed to be. But we never actually question whether it's actually supposed to be that way.
Yeah.
Like, is the world really supposed to be like a hyper male dominated yeah. world where women are objects? And yeah. I don't think the answer is yes, but that's, I think part of where it comes from is this general sense of like things have changed, things are changing, and we've got to go back.
Mm-hmm.
And so this passage gets brought up in that sense.
So verse 23 says, for a husband is the head of his wife as Christ is the head of the church. What does that mean? What is headship?
Mm.
What does headship mean?
That's a good question. There's a whole bunch of different schools of thought on this. One school of thought is that he's just describing the way that marriage worked back then. The headship meaning some form of leadership, meaning some form mm-hmm. of like your head is the you cut off your head, you die, your body dies. So there's some sense of that where Christ is the head of the church. That's one argument. There's another whole argument based on an alternate meaning of the word kephale, which means the word head, which means source. And so it gets more into the idea of provision and protection. It's like Christ is the source of life to the church. He's the one that provides sustenance and existence to the church. And in the same way, the husband in ancient Anatolia was the source to the wife. He's the one that provides some level of existence and security and safety to the woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tend to fall into that latter camp when I think about this passage, but I could be wrong. Either way, I don't think either of them would be out of character for someone in the first century to say. But the idea of the husband being the source it's less about domineering, and it's more to what I said in my message
right.
about like, look, the husband's job is to protect you. You can't go it alone. It's 62 AD. Like you're not able to just go out with this newfound freedom in Jesus and be a strong, independent woman. It's the first century. You will die, or you will become a prostitute, or like
yeah.
you just can't. So don't let your newfound freedom in Christ tear into two what was meant to be one. And it gets really complicated because the letter to the Ephesians was probably a circular letter in Western Asia or mm-hmm. Western Asia Minor. So it wasn't necessarily written directly to Ephesus, but it is interesting to think about the culture of that area in Ephesus. The temple of Artemis was like the big thing. It was the attraction for that entire region. So they have a very specific view on Artemis that's a little distinct from the rest of the Greek perspective. And so it's very much she's very much a goddess of the woman, the virgin, the
fertility.
Mother, fertility. It's this kind of, and so there's a significant level of like female empowerment in Ephesus that's in the water stream. And so I could imagine, and I don't know, but I could imagine that there were some women that they took this sort of concept of like women being valued, important, whatever. And then they hear all this stuff about the freedom that comes from Jesus, the freedom to be freed from some of the laws of humanity. And maybe the women in Ephesus or in that region were starting to be those strong, independent women that we would probably celebrate today. But back in that time, it started to become really disruptive to the homes. And again, Paul's thinking, how do, like you said, Maren, how do we represent the love of Christ to our world in our families? And if women are starting to break apart all the structural norms back then, Paul perhaps had a reason to say, hey, don't cut yourself off from the source. Your husband is the one that's whose job it is to protect you. Don't cut yourself off from that. So again, this is all, I'm talking all in terms of first century culture here. That's just the complexity of biblical interpretation, but that's how some
people
see it.
It's so important. You said yesterday, we do damage to the text when we take it out of context and we don't talk about the world behind it.
Yeah.
Rarely have I ever heard this passage preached in light of its cultural setting, 62 AD. Mm-hmm. It's so important. I think about what was courtship like back then?
Right.
I don't think women were going out, you know, identifying for themselves, you know, what husband they were going to get linked up with. It was totally the opposite. Men were the pursuers and men were the providers. They had to prove that they could provide before the father would even, you know, relinquish his daughter to be married to said man.
Sure.
It was so much a transactional thing. Anyway, having to think of it all in light of that, I've always read this passage as like a very utopian kind of ideal, you know, if the husband were to really love his wife the way Christ loved the church and lay his life down for her, considering her needs above his, just how utopian is that?
Right.
And how glorious would it be to submit to a husband who I knew loved me that much that he'd lay down his whole life for me? You wouldn't, that'd be a no-brainer.
Right.
Yeah. I would not even have to think about that. It's such a beautiful picture, but then we've taken it and turned it into such a divisive thing, which is hideous to me. I read this and I just see Christ's love. I see, verse 28, in the same way, husbands ought to love their wives as they love their own bodies. For a man who loves his wife actually shows love for himself. Imagine that. Imagine that.
Right. And this is just striking me now as I hear that, love their own bodies and care for their own bodies. One of the big things back then was gymnasiums and baths. So like one of the things archaeologists find in every single Greek and Roman city is gymnasiums and baths. Gymnasiums was where all the dudes went to go get swole, you know, like lift weights and run around and I don't know, do cool stuff. And baths were where all the men went to have to get massages and to clean themselves and to hang out. And it was all very social. And so like the life of a man in ancient Anatolia was spent a lot of time was spent in gyms and at baths. Cause that's where the social fabric of the society happened. And so, a lot of your life is focused on making your body, healthy and strong and caring for yourself. And so, even there, that makes even more sense of that passage to say like, hey, you spend all that time caring for your body. Like, what if you treated your wife the same way?
Verse 29, the very next verse. No one hates his own body, but feeds it and cares for it, just as Christ cares for the church. And we are members of one body.
Right.
I wonder if that was revolutionary to them, to see your wife as essentially a member of your own body, not as
unified.
Some sort of like, not as some sort of outside piece of property, but as an actual piece of who you are, so much so that you were to feed her and care for her as though she were
you,
part of you,
And it seems like Paul is trying to tie headship, the word headship or the word head, to Christ in the church. And so the unifying relationship between Christ and the church, not really defined like who's in charge, who's the leader with the word head. And even if you read a couple, a little bit further and you ask one question, like, okay, if Christ is the head of the church, how did he become head of the church? Mm. And the answer isn't, well, he just exerted his dominion over it.
Right.
He went to the cross.
It's through, he gave up his life and he, that's how he saved her. He sacrificed everything for the church. And so, it's more of a unifying relationship, I think, when we talk about head,
yeah,
then just being like, all right, you're in charge because the head's in charge, you know?
It's interesting too, when you go on and you read Ephesians 6, this household code continues and he talks to slaves and masters. And when you read this, again, as a modern person, we recoil because slaves obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling and singleness of heart as you obey Christ, not only while being watched and in order to please them, but as slaves of Christ doing the will of God from the heart. That is horrifying to us. Like the idea that the Bible is telling slaves to like obey their masters like they're obeying Christ. And yet when you think of the ancient context, if you were a servant or a slave of someone else, like how tempting would it be to do it as the bare minimum of work to care for that person's, the job that is in front of you. Mm-hmm. Right. And that he's saying, no, work with all your heart, work as if you're working for Jesus, which by itself is still kind of like, ugh, I don't know about that. It feels a bit like wives submit to your husbands. And then you read what he says to masters. Masters, do the same to them. Mm. Stop threatening them. For you know that both of you have the same master in heaven, and with him there is no partiality. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, masters are being told to treat their slaves to respect, to serve them.
What version are you reading from? That's not the NLT.
NRSV.
That's not the NLT.
NRSV. New what's the NLT? What's the NLT say?
It says, don't masters treat your slaves in the same way. Don't threaten them. Remember, you both have the same master in heaven, and he has no favorites.
Oh yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not used to you now reading from this NLT.
Sorry, I just had the NRSV pulled up. Anyway, but what I'm trying to get at is the idea that we've had this long conversation recently about the history of slavery and the church's interpretation of it. That's not what we're going to get into now, but there were plenty of people, Christians, who used this passage and others like it as proof that God's okay with slavery. And so the transatlantic slave trade was great because God endorsed it explicitly in scripture. Yeah. Whereas if you really look at this passage in the first century context, it is nuts.
Yeah.
It's insane that masters should be treating their slaves with that much respect and dignity, not having partiality, that God doesn't look and see a master and a slave as different. Like this is wild. And so if we're really talking about interpreting these passages and applying them to our world, we would actually see this and say that in our context, in our modern world, this should actually lead us to be even more abolitionist than anybody. This same exact passage that's used as a justification for slavery is actually a justification for abolition, and it should lead us—
Because of how radical it was.
Because of how radical it was then, what should it be like now? And so let's take the same concept to our marriages and look at this and say, this wives submit to your husbands has been used as an endorsement of abuse— when in actuality, the idea of a self-crucified husband should be transforming our entire way of thinking about marriage. So I just find that super fascinating.
How do we miss that through centuries? He has no favorites.
Right.
Are we that perverse that we just
hang
on to the parts that support our agenda and completely ignore the parts that say he has no favorites?
Right. I mean, yeah, I think one of the themes of Ephesians is the powers of our world. And one of the things, and I don't know the verse off the top of my head, but there's a verse in Ephesians where Paul says that we show the powers of the world that Christ is king by the way we love one another. And what I think we miss is when we think of the powers of this world only in terms of like Satan and demons and evil spirits and whatever, we miss the fact that what the powers of the world really are corrupting influences that take true ideas and then they twist them ever so slightly. And so it's the powers of the world that have helped our corrupted minds to take these passages, which were meant for good, and to turn them into a license for abuse. So it's not that they just flat out lied. It's that they took the truth and then they twisted it 10 degrees. And now all of a sudden we've got abuse in marriages. Endorsement of slavery. Yeah. So I think to get back to that quote, which I should probably look it up. The idea that we are showing the powers of this world, the lordship of Christ by the way we love one another. Like that to me is exactly what we're talking about. Yeah. It's like, now we have an opportunity to do what the church has failed to do so far, which is to rightly divide the word of truth, to rightly interpret and apply what Paul was actually saying in this passage. Mm.
Two more questions. Something that was interesting to me in Paul's talking to husbands and talking about how Christ loved the church. He uses words like make her clean mm-hmm. and washed and without a spot or wrinkle and feeds and cares for to describe how Christ loved the church.
Yeah.
Is there anything interesting about that set of language that he chose to use when talking to husbands? To me, it's like, he's using words that we would say, well, that's the traditional, those are traditional things that we would picture a woman doing, making clean and making sure there's no wrinkles or blemishes.
Interesting.
Feeds and cares for.
Very nurturing language.
Yeah, very nurturing, like traditional gender role of a wife. And I was like, oh, yeah, that had to be on purpose.
Yeah, now that you say it, I'm 100% convinced of that. Yeah. I was thinking of it in terms of ritual purity, and maybe there's a double layer here. I bet there is a double layer here, because for Christ to do that to us, he's not literally feeding us, although right. he's feeding us like his body and blood. He's making us pure and clean in the sense of the guilt and the shame that we carried through our sin is now being washed away. So there's that level, but you're right. It's like, the husband is doing for the wife what traditionally was the woman's role. That's actually profound. Good job, Tyler. I love that.
Nailed it. All right, that's it. Let's get out of here.
No, that's really cool.
Okay, so finally, you gave three examples of how modern husbands can do what we're talking about here. Yeah. You said share the mental load, which we've kind of touched on for a second.
Yeah.
Pursue your wife and what she cares about, mm-hmm. and then make the first move. There's probably a list of a million things we could do. What stood out about those three? That you wanted to make sure they were a part of your sermon.
Well, again, what I was trying to do with this was to think through, like, what do I see as the major symptoms of that we're facing right now? And so these are just some of the things that I think are most problematic. So for example, husbands don't share the mental load. We already covered that. But also, husbands rarely seem to actually think about their wife. Like, there's no like mental space. She doesn't live on her. She's not taking up like mental space as a person that they're thinking of her needs and her desires outside of like her birthday. And even when it's her birthday, it's like, well, what am I supposed to do? Yeah. I don't know what she likes. Yeah. I don't know what to get her. And that, I think it's almost like some sort of weird, like mental block. That's almost like, it's like default to men in general, but like, this is something we could do. This is something we could do better at. And then the third one, making the first move. This is, I've sensed, maybe I haven't had people say it explicitly, but I've sensed that there's this general hesitancy of like, okay, I'm fine with the concept mm-hmm. of mutual submission, but you don't know my wife.
Yeah.
Like, she's a piece of work, or she's domineering, or she would never submit to me, or she would never like lower herself. And so I'm not going to just be a doormat.
Mm. Yeah.
And so until I see her start to, you know, show an interest in self-giving love, I'm not going to demonstrate it myself. Yeah. And so that, to me, this is more imagined, but it's kind of the vibe that I get sometimes when people are thinking like, it all sounds well and good, but you don't know.
Yeah, especially if there's like pain in the relationship. Absolutely. It's like if there is like pain that you've experienced together as a couple, and it's easy to lean back on, well, I've been conditioned in a certain way, and so therefore I'm not going to do this unless I see so and so put forth an effort. But
There is a risk. I mean, there are definitely situations where women are abusive or manipulative or will take advantage of any of this. And so there is a risk. Like, but that's kind of the nature of self-giving love. You don't know what the result will be. And so I guess it's probably worth pointing out, I didn't say this in the message, I did in the husband's retreat, but there are situations where men are at the mercy of a very abusive situation, and you shouldn't continue to put up with it any more than a woman who's in an abusive situation should continue to put up with it.
Yeah.
Like, God does not want you to suffer in the sense of of being at the mercy of injustice. Mm-hmm. He wants you to thrive and both. And so there's that nuance. But I think for the bulk, for the majority of men, what they will find, in my opinion and my experience, is that their self-giving love or their self-sacrifice will be responded to with a significant level of surprise, joy, amazement, happiness. Like it's the kind of thing that can bring great healing to a marriage, because the stereotype is that this is not what the husband ever does.
Yeah.
So that's all I'm saying. It's like, I think it's an opportunity to go, to make the first move, to start that race to the bottom. I think it's an opportunity to bring healing into a marriage. And so I think it's important. That's, mm-hmm. yeah. that's what I was thinking with those three.
All right. Yeah. Where do we go after this? What are we doing next?
It's Amy preaching. She'll be
It's Maren.
Oh, you're right. It's me. It around. I forgot. Sorry. I forgot we swapped. It's you, it's but me. You're preaching about parents. Parents.
Yes. God's invitation to the parents. What's God saying to us? Parent type folk.
Parent type folk.
Yes. That's where we're going.
Any teaser? What can we expect?
Oh man.
Parents getting a spanking.
I will say, so Friday morning I woke up at 4:30.
Sick.
Which is not like me. I was sick. However, I woke up with this song in my head. Like it was playing in my dream. And then when I woke up and opened my eyes,
Cats
the song
the
was still there and the silver spoon. Little boy blue and the man in the moon. That's not the one. We had a song lined up to follow the message. But as a result of Friday night's dream, which I first had to make sure was not a fever dream, I went and I changed course entirely.
Oh, no.
It was just one of those things where I was like, this is either a fever dream or the Holy Spirit is giving me inspiration in the middle of the night and I need to be obedient. So I took a day to pray about it and talk to my team about it and am I crazy and whatever. So I've altered course.
Okay. Well, we'll see how that goes. All right, Barry, good luck on your writing retreat.
Thanks.
We'll be the beneficiaries of that, I anticipate.
If you go to the Revelation class or go to or watch my skeptics class online.
All right, good. So we'll be back next week. Maren, can you please send us out?
I sure will. Do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God.
And we'll see you on the other side of Sunday.